I want to talk to you today about an approach to developing AIDS media and education materials by using the community as a resource. Although Australia is not a developing country, my people, Black Australians, have a health status similar to that of third world countries. This includes a high prevalence of substance abuse, widespread malnutrition, poor living environments, inadequate essential services, low educational achievement and high unemployment. The approach of using the community as a main resource is applicable to any society which has limited technical, professional and monetary resources. This is our only strength. Citizenship was granted to my people 20 years ago, but we only have one graduate medical doctor and very few registered nurses. It is therefore essential that Black health workers are the key element in the teaching of all health education, reasons being the workers have a practical knowledge of our culture, a commitment to raising the health status of our community, a knowledge of health education issues and local issues, an understanding of the restrictions faced in any problems in our community, and a degree of credibility in our community that visiting experts cannot quickly achieve. Although AIDS is not a major problem yet amongst Black Australians, poor sanitation leading to poor health status with a high incidence of hepatitis B and chlamydia lays the community open to the spread of this virus. The Western health system has much to learn from the approach taken in the mobilisation of Black communities by our own health workers. In the past, Western health educators have tried to educate our people, but with little understanding of our culture, and by using their own methods of health education, they have understandably failed. The approach taken has three main components: consultation to work in Black communities with local people, networking to use established Black health worker networks, and pre-testing of communication materials, which involves Black health workers in developing, pre-testing and running public health campaigns. It is essential that the workshops happen in Black environments so that the contributors feel comfortable. The workshop team consists of a doctor, a nurse, a health educator, a communication consultant, and a graphic artist. The workshop begins with short introductions and information sessions about AIDS. This is followed by sessions on basic rules of communication, how to develop media materials, and plan a health education campaign, deciding aims and objectives, selecting target audiences, and developing messages conveyed are key elements of this process. The ideas of the workshop participants are recorded, and the graphic artist and communication consultant develop several concepts based on these ideas. The following day, these concepts are presented in rough visual form to the workshop. The participants are enthusiastic on their response when they see their ideas expressed in the communication materials. Once again, note is taken of the workshop reactions to the various concepts, particularly what people say, how they physically react, with laughter, puzzlement, seriousness, and most importantly, their ideas for changes. These changes are then incorporated into further versions of the materials. Community members are then invited to review and comment on the materials to gain a wider target audience response and to refine the materials to a final acceptable stage. The workshop then votes on which posters, slogans or advertisements it thinks are the strongest and most effective. The next session of the workshop develops action plans related to specific activities that can be undertaken in this campaign. These action plans bring together networking, research, planning and evaluation. These elements are then developed into specific activities related to networks used by the health workers. In many of the slides, I've used the colours red, black and yellow. These colours are the colours of the Black Australian flag and are instantly recognisable to my people. This is an example of being culturally specific in your communications. When my people see these colours, we know the communication is for us and we usually trust the message. The most important aspect of the training workshop is that it produces materials, posters, radio ads, action plans on the spot, and pre-test these materials in local communities. This approach reinforces the importance of black health workers and develops strategies that fit into existing structures and networks. It also trains health workers in the essential ingredients of conceiving, planning, and implementing a media campaign concerned with health issues. Most importantly, the health education program that is developed is relevant to that particular community and is owned by that community. This particular poster, Condom Man, which some of in the audience have already heard this story. We usually use the term Frenchies rather than condom, and in an area where teenage pregnancy is very high, I called the mothers and the teenagers together and spoke to them about having one sexual partner. And I told them that if they couldn't abstain from sex or just have one partner, it was very important to use condoms. And that night, one of the mothers contacted me and said they really don't have a problem with AIDS there because their children are made to eat condoms every day, which is a local fruit tree in that particular area. So we then changed the whole concept of this poster, and which is now becoming internationally acclaimed. This program, of course, would not have been possible without community involvement, which has been part of our cultural heritage spanning over 40,000 years. Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is Peter Jackson. I'm from the British Deaf Association, the AIDS Ahead Project. I was very interested to learn about your programme, Ms. Smallwood, your programme and you outlined in Australia with your Australian black people. Because deaf people themselves and other groups of handicapped people, like the deaf themselves, the deaf blind and blind people and so on, groups like that, they also find that they need special development of resources to suit their particular groups and their needs. For instance, sign language, braille, and so on. This special kind of resource is required, and we need support. And what we're having to do is develop these ourselves. What I would like to ask you is what kind of funding or resource supports have you received from your own Australian government?
Well, I'm glad someone asked me that question. If you'd pick up in my paper, I did say that 20 years ago we were given citizenship. I am the only black registered nurse in our country that has had 20 years in the field of public health and have lectured up to 20,000 people in the last 3 years on AIDS, and I am unemployed. All my work is voluntary. The project I did with my people, I rode a push bike around and I went to football clubs, anywhere where there were blacks gathering or any street children, black and white, and gave all my services voluntary. For 6 months, our government, after a lot of political hassles and support from women's groups in my country, the federal government gave me 6 months funding, and there is no funds to employ me due to the incredible amounts of money in our country. So if you want to know where I'm getting resources from, I'm not getting any, and I'm continuing to do my work, which is very effective because I'm dealing with people at grassroots level with no funding.
Prostitute women in London are aware of AIDS and the risks they may run in the course of their work. Some have recently produced literature of this kind, recommending condom use, safer sex and needle hygiene. Prostitute women are also aware of the excuse that AIDS has provided for the further suppression of prostitution. They tend to see what they describe as a social crusade against the sale of sex as the greater threat. I shall explore their point of view in this talk. This is a leaflet produced by the Blood Transfusion Service, which lists groups who are thought to be at risk of HIV infection. Note that prostitutes are listed second. On what ground? It is assumed that prostitutes are likely to have greater than average number of sexual partners, and they will therefore be more exposed to HIV infection. It is supposed further that once the levels of infection are greater than those in the general population, that prostitute women may play a role in the further spread of the virus. However, it is already known that the picture is more complicated than this, as I shall explore briefly with reference to some studies in Africa and in the West. This gives a crude picture with some of the figures from Africa, where patterns of infection are consistent with heterosexual spread. There's approximately a 1-to-1 ratio, peaking in the most sexually active years, with a higher mean age in men than in women. Clusters of infection have been traced which are linked by heterosexual spread. The percentages in this slide have been rounded up. You can see that there's a very great range, from 0% to 88%. The first two lines also illustrate a pattern of urban concentration, which is common to a number of countries. Here you see in Tanzania that there's a 29% prevalence amongst women tested in Dar es Salaam, as compared with 0 in Arusha. The second two lines here illustrate the importance of workplace. A 31% prevalence amongst bar workers, contrast with a 66% prevalence amongst slum workers in Nairobi. In some studies, high levels of infection in prostitutes were found relatively early on, and other prevalence figures suggest that these women played a role in further viral spread, as among prostitute women to men with sexually transmitted diseases in Nairobi. Identified risks in some studies include numbers of partners, sex with prostitutes, and being a prostitute. It seems, therefore, that patterns of infection in some African prostitutes are consistent with the picture that I just outlined concerning their possibly central role in transmission. But identified risks in the West do not currently fit this picture. In this slide, you can see nearly as great a range as in the last one, from 0 to 59%. But the only consistent risk factor is injecting drug use. In other words, injecting drug use in the West currently provides an indicator of the same order as heterosexual activity in Africa. Two points suggest some modification to this picture. First, it might be objected that infection through shared needles is overestimated and acquisition through heterosexual activity is underestimated due to the weighting of risk factors in the West. Reciprocally, in Africa, it has been suggested that infection may also be associated with dirty needles in some studies. Second, you can see on the second line here that women working in the inner city in South Florida are at substantial risk of infection, even if they do not inject drugs. A 46% prevalence amongst injecting drug users contrasts with a 30% prevalence amongst non-users. Factors associated with infection in this latter group, apart from work in the inner city, include numbers of clients, numbers of black clients, and a history of hepatitis B and syphilis. In spite of these modifications, the basic contrast remains between injecting drug use in the West and heterosexual activity in Africa. I shall not talk further of these studies, but simply underline an obvious but important point that has emerged. The prevalence varies, and it's associated with different local risk factors. Moreover, the prevalence of HIV infection is not a simple measure of sexual activity. In some parts of the world, it provides a closer measure of patterns of needle use. As far as HIV infection is concerned, there is no general identity to the term prostitute. It shouldn't be assumed that needle use is the only factor that complicates the picture. I shall give a second illustration from our study in London. We recruit self-referred and self-defined prostitutes to a cohort at a central London sexually transmitted disease clinic.
Women are screened for sexually transmitted infection. Blood is taken for serology. And detailed information is collected on lifestyle, particularly sexual behaviour. We're looking at the relationship between lifestyle and infection. Although a representative sample can't be guaranteed, we've aimed to reflect as much diversity as possible because this has been associated with different risks of infection. This slide shows the range of workplaces represented, with the highest figures at the top of the slide for escort workers, street workers, sauna workers, and private workers. We have 17 women who currently or in the past have used needles to inject drugs. The age of the women ranges from 16 to 53 years. They've been working for between 1 month and 27 years. And they've been followed up at the clinic for a median of 7 months, over the 17 months of the study to December 1987. It's worth repeating the HIV prevalence figures for this cohort. 150 women have been screened. 3 are positive. 2 have shared needles in the past. And 1 seems to have been infected by her seropositive boyfriend. I want to explore this one woman further and ask whether she represents an isolated case or points towards a more general pattern for the future. I shall do this by looking at patterns of condom use in different situations. This illustrates a central point. To anticipate, Cupid and condoms don't mix. Whilst women insist on condom use with their clients, that is with men who pay them for sex, they don't with their boyfriends, that is with their non-paying or private sexual partners. The basic contrast I shall illustrate concerns clients who pay for sex and boyfriends who don't. There's a second important contrast between types of clients, between new clients or strangers, and regular clients, or men who pay the same woman for sex repeatedly. The information here concerns the 91 women who were seen on 2 or more occasions at the clinic by the end of last year. 75 of them have boyfriends. Only 7%, that is 5 women, use condoms with these men all the time, as compared to 56%, that's 51 women, who use condoms with their clients. You can see in the left-hand column here. This contrast has, in fact, deepened with time because women are increasingly insisting that their clients wear condoms. This gives a crude indication of change over time from first visit to most recent visit as of summer 1987, here and here. Just over 50% of women insisted on condoms with their clients all the time at recruitment, as compared to nearly 80% by the summer of last year. The number of women who did not use condoms with their clients dropped during this period. Moreover, unprotected sex with clients doesn't concern simply a random sample. In the last 3 months of 1987, only 1% of sexual encounters with new clients, representing just one occasion, were unprotected, as compared to 21%, representing 28 encounters with regular clients down here. Regulars are well known to the women, and it's difficult to persuade them to wear condoms. Sometimes they are too much like friends. These figures show a trend towards universal condom use with new clients, as compared to a more variable pattern with regular clients, and little or no use at all with boyfriends. It might be hypothesized accordingly that prostitute women in the London cohort are less likely to be infected by their clients than by their non-paying male partners, their boyfriends. Furthermore, it is unlikely that they will infect their clients, even though they may remain at risk from their boyfriends. This is the picture suggested by patterns of condom use and initially confirmed by the one HIV-positive woman who does not use needles. Clearly, this scenario depends partly on how effective condoms are as a barrier. Women attending the clinic are given information on how to use condoms in the hope of cutting down failure rate. The pattern of infection so far is also likely to reflect low levels of infection among clients of prostitutes. At present, however, identified risks among London prostitutes have nothing to do with their relatively high levels of sexual activity, measured by rates of partner change. Women are not at risk from their work, but from their private lives, from sharing needles, and from sex with seropositive boyfriends. These two illustrations concerning needle use and relations with boyfriends
show that risks for HIV infection cannot be seen purely as a function of the number of partners with whom these women have sex. These illustrations suggest that risks for HIV infection are attached to prostitutes in the course of their lives, and not just in the course of one of their activities, selling sex. I suggest that the risks outlined, which are associated with women's private lives, are still related to the organization of prostitution. This can be shown by means of a wider definition of prostitution, as the point at which the exchange of sex for money is accompanied by attitudes of disapproval and often legal penalty. The criminalization of many aspects of prostitution promotes an association between the sale of sex and drug use, as well as dependency upon the protection that may be offered by boyfriends. To take drug use first and briefly, it is often assumed that drug use is only related pragmatically to prostitution. In other words, women sell sex in order to finance a habit, or they take drugs in order to make their work bearable. However, a number of studies are beginning to document a long historical association between the organization of prostitution and the marketing of illicit drugs that calls this individualist explanation into question. Similarly, relations with boyfriends are better understood in terms of the criminalization of prostitution. In the UK, for example, it is illegal to solicit. Men may bring business to their prostitute girlfriend. Working conditions are unsafe, and men may protect their prostitute girlfriends from violence. These men, therefore, act as managers, and they operate a protection racket. They are likely, therefore, to be running more than one woman. If prostitute women are to be associated with risks of HIV infection because they're having unprotected sex with perhaps one boyfriend and one or two regular clients, then their boyfriends are equally at risk through having unprotected sex with multiple partners, including other prostitute women. We have anecdotal information that suggests about half of the boyfriends of women in the cohort have a number of sexual partners simultaneously. However, the risks associated with the activities of these men are currently unknown. This brief sketch suggests that neither needle use nor relations with boyfriend in the London cohort can be understood without reference to the social and legal context in which these women operate. This includes what might be called a scapegoat factor, reflected in media reports and recommendations for the compulsory screening of prostitutes, followed by the isolation of infected individuals. Recommendations for some sort of control are likely to create two classes of prostitutes, where those who do not want to be screened are driven further underground. This might well exacerbate infection for those women who will have even less access to healthcare than they already have, and will have little or no access to information about safer sex or needle hygiene. Such women might also be at risk as they are forced into greater dependency on boyfriends and other managers of an illegal industry, and as they are forced to work harder in order to pay them protection money. It can be concluded, therefore, that the study of prostitution necessarily becomes one of social marginalization and its effects, whilst the prevention of HIV infection amongst prostitutes and their associates necessarily involves this wider social and legal environment, as well as safer working practices. To return to the title, the data presented shows enormous diversity. Prostitute women cannot be seen as a single risk group. This image of a group in AIDS research simply reinforces popular and negative attitudes towards the sale of sex, which keeps the scapegoat idea alive and consequently creates risks for working women. This image of a group, contradicted by the empirical findings, raises a question. Is the collective identity of prostitutes, such as it is, forced upon women from the outside by the scapegoat factor, rather than built up internally through common working practices? In summary, I've argued that there is no general identity to the term prostitute. Possible risk activities as far as HIV transmission is concerned can only be established empirically. These may relate to high levels of heterosexual activity, which are part of work. They may equally relate to prostitutes' private lives and to the wider social context in which these women operate. It should be emphasized that the scapegoat role that is forced upon prostitute women cannot be divorced from other risk activity. Generally negative attitudes, legally institutionalized, themselves create risks for working women, particularly for the accessible ones, poorer and younger women working in slums and on the streets. Thank you.